Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I'm the aforementioned Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. This is a quick reminder for those who are joining us live. Make sure and join the chat room there at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. If you have some observations you'd like to make or some questions you want to roll into the program for ourselves or our guests, go ahead and put it in there and we'll pull her into the conversation. And if you're new to Midrats and you'd like to catch up on some of the previous shows we've had, or you've been listening to us for a while and just happened to miss a week or two, you can always listen to the archives over at Blog Talk Radio. Or better yet, just go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast via iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. Like I mentioned in some of the pre-advertisements there, the Libya operation isn't completely done. There's still a few pro-Qaddafi forces out there that will be cleaned up. But for the Western Arab nations, even though it's not over with, for those that provided literally the top cover for the Libyan rebels, there's some initial observations that you can make that can be useful in both policy going forward and making sure that we have the right mix. And as we look forward to some of the economic and budgetary pressures that we're seeing, and of course our European allies have seen in spades for a while, those are not trivial issues. As the Brits saw, when you decide to save a few monies by getting rid of your carrier air, all of a sudden when you pick up the bat phone, there is no bat on the other end. And so today to discuss for the full hour will be Dr. Robin Laird. He's a Washington and Paris-based defense consultant. He's worked a lot with U.S. services on very strategic issues. He's also published two recent books, Renorming of Air Power and 21st Century Air Capabilities. Robin, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Great. And Robin, what got me wanting to call you and ask you to come on was an article I read from you over at Second Line of Defense. The listeners can find a link over at my home blog. If not, just go sldinfo.com. There's some great stuff there. Before we start diving into some of the initial observations we've seen from the military operations in Libya, just take for a second and explain to the listener what they'll find over at sldinfo.com. Also, what is Second Line of Defense, and what are some of the primary issues that y'all work over there?
Well, I started the website. There are actually four websites, including a magazine in French and a French website. We are Paris and Washington based. And we started the website out of frustration as much as anything else, which is the absence of real news on the building of military capabilities. And from my point of view, military capabilities is a function that you can build something, you can deploy something, you've got a CONOPS approach, and you can sustain it. So logistics is a hardcore subject for us. And what you'll find over there is we own the F-35 capability conversation. We've done much work on the F-35. We've done many, many interviews with practitioners, whether they be in industry or deployed forces. A lot of Coast Guard stuff. The Post has written a lot of stuff using our Coast Guard material. So we do a lot of maritime things, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. And I would say we're also international. So if you went to the website right now, you'd find we have a comprehensive series on Turkey from one of our members who is in Turkey this past week. You would find a complete read-up on the Libyan operation, including the French perspective, the French operators involved in that operation.
When you When you take a look at the Libya operation, where do you start, and
And I noticed one of the things you sort of take a look at is the effect of the U.S. leading from behind. Can you kind of walk through that process?
And in general, I'll speak specifically to what I've actually looked at as opposed to speculated about. You know, whether we should have done this operation or not, I'm just bracketing and putting that aside. We can, of course, discuss that. But what it does suggest is this kind of pickup operation where something happens fairly quickly, a kind of black swan, may require you to have a very agile force structure. And when we're looking at transition in our force structure, we have to go from a fairly antiquated, rigid, land-based force structure that we've built over the last decade to one that's much more agile. Now, we look at Libya specifically. I've interviewed all the senior Marines involved in the operation, meaning the Amphibious Ready Group folks, and, of course, I've done for years of work on the Osprey as well. And I had the opportunity while I was in Paris to interview the Air Operations Chief, who just retired, several Navy officers as well. And I found a considerable amount of tactical commonality between what the U.S. and the French did in this operation, which is very, very suggestive of command and control for this kind of operation and the utility of sea basing.
The two things that you mentioned off the top there, the importance of agile and flexible forces, the utility of sea basing, a lot of that kind of folds into at least the sea part of the air-sea battle concept. I don't want to really dive off that diving board, so to speak, right now. But when you look at that specific part of the experience, and I know you've mentioned that it's a little premature for lessons learned, but there are some insights that we can glean right now from this stage of the operation. Are those two of your top three takeaways? And if you just had, just a couple minutes to sit down with somebody and jot down on the cocktail napkin, these are the three things that you need to have your smart people thinking about right now, what would they be?
Well, I think the first one, and I've written about this on AOL Defense, is the significance of having multiple bases to operate from. One of the things the Congress and administration is rushing to do is get rid of bases, which is a very short-sighted thing. So in the case of the Marines, Sigonella, a naval base in Italy, was supposed to be shut. If we didn't have Sigonella, I have no idea how we would have done this operation. I'll turn to that in a minute again. And for the French, they had a very specific basing strategy, which included a significant operation with Arab partners. The Arabs operated with the French, basically. We have to understand that, and we can talk to that a little bit. It's very, very interesting. So the first point is multiple basing is a good thing. Second thing is that having basing at sea as part of your entire CONOPS of doing the operation has also significant advantages, which we can talk about specifically what those advantages are in a minute. And thirdly, I would say that the Osprey shocked people. That is to say, part of the problem inside the Beltway is that this is a debate about the past, not the future. And what folks won't understand, just won't accept, is that the new systems like 35s and Ospreys and so on open up new possibilities for ourselves and our allies. So in the specific case of this operation, the way I would put it is that when the administration decided to do something and then coined this rather absurd concept of lead from behind, the military interpreted this as the opportunity to not use frontline TAC air. So the F-22, which was actually in the Middle East, so the Air Force denies it, was in the UAE, was flown home. The Navy leadership moved the carrier, the Enterprise, through the Suez Canal over to Afghanistan. And we were left on frontline air with very, very few Air Force assets and the very, very old Amphibious Ready Group. You've got to realize Ozzy Osbourne, the 15th MEU commander who commanded the Kearsarge, which was one of the ships used, he said that the ship should probably have sails. It's so old. And we should talk about amphibious ships a little bit later. But the end of the day, what happened was that the Osprey, and we've only had the Osprey operational for 3 years, and as you well know, when folks use this stuff, they come up with some very interesting innovations. Well, what happened in this particular operation, which was historically unprecedented but won't be going forward, is that the Osprey was used as a logistical linchpin for the Ark, meaning that the very old Harriers, who need a lot of maintenance, could double or triple their sortie rates over what you would expect because they were supported by Osprey lists from Sigonella to the Kearsarge. And then, of course, we should discuss the trap or rescue mission, which was historically unprecedented as well. We should talk a bit about that.
One of the things you mentioned in some of your articles is it seems to be that you took a look at the Air Force KAOC system, which I guess is a combined air operations center, and sort of discount that for these sort of littoral operations where you need to, and I guess in your view, if you want to clarify this, you need to have the C2 and the intel out there where the pilots are coming in and in this short cycle. I think you said 100 mile operation. Did I state that correctly?
Well, that's correct. And there are three ways to look at this. One is that the F-35A will change the Air Force's KAOC system anyway. I mean, their own 35s will do that. And when they fully embrace what the 22 delivers to them, they will as well. So the KAOC system will change as you use the pilot-centered aircraft. I mean, the 35s, from this point of view, it's a C4ISR-enabled aircraft inside the cockpit. And that will require radical change in the KAOC structure. That's the first point. Second point was that we had limited unmanned aerial vehicles involved in this operation, and my own view is that dynamic targeting, which we went to very quickly in this operation, meaning I had to discern who to hit and who not to hit in a very fluid environment without significant ground forces. In that kind of environment, basically, UAVs are not very useful. In fact, this was one of the tension points between the French and the U.S. Air Force was over the speed of delivering the capability. The complaint was largely about the U.S. Air Force, but it wasn't fair. It's just the Predator. If you look on the website, I did an interview with an F-18 Marine Corps pilot who specifically said that there are precious seconds it takes to get the information from the UAV dead to the ground guy, and that amount of time he could be dead. So this basically raises questions about the billions of dollars of investment in UAVs, which we can turn to in a minute. And then the third point really is that the sea base was used by both the French and the Marine Corps quite differently than folks conceptualize of C2. And I'll speak to that right now. So for the Marines, and you saw this in the trap mission, in the rescue mission, which we should talk about a bit, but basically what happened is that the Harriers were flying off of the Kearsarge, and they were using the Lightning Pod, the Northrop Grumman Lightning Pod, and of course the Harrier, the F-35B is not a replacement for the Harrier, it's a replacement for three aircraft. But what they got out of the Lightning Pod, they would fly the mission, they'd come back, the data would be on the ship, they would then make targeting solutions, send up the next Harrier wave, and, you know, this is 10 minutes since the last guys went across. So you got a very short C2 cycle, so if the tanks hadn't moved very far or the APCs hadn't moved very far. Now, that's, in short, how the Marines used the advantage of the sea base. For the French, they had two ships initially. They had their amphibious ship called Le Tonnerre, which was replaced by the Mistral halfway through, and the De Gaulle. And the way this operated for them, we go back to the multiple basings thing, which is, of course, when you start the operation, you're coming from mainland, from the French territory, but quickly, they went to a three-basing strategy. They ended up using Ceuta Bay, where they flew with the Arab Air Forces. The Arab Air Forces, for the first time, using a lot of new ordnance. Secondly, they flew from Corsica, and they flew their new recce pods on their Rafales. I did an interview just on this. It's on the website. And what they ended up doing is they dropped the recce data on the De Gaulle and Le Tonnerre, which is their amphibious ship. And they would sort out the targeting solution sets and upload those to the 2000D-9s, which were flying from Ceuta Bay, which included strikes from Arabs on Libya. So that cycle was very, very useful. And we wrote a piece in Space News last week on the potential implications for operationally responsive space that come from this as well. So I think this kind of pickup operation where you don't have a lot of time to do months of careful planning does raise questions about, you know, how you can use some of these new assets or new CONOPs much more effectively.
I think I wanted to pull the string a little bit more on the UASs, UAV, depending upon which program manager you talk to. I mean, the French have, and some of you've written some real good information on this, but the French have really produced what I see as some very clear-headed and important reminders about some of the fundamentals of dynamic targeting that really have not changed in decades, and it flies in the face of the big advocates of UAS, UAVs. I mean, I once almost had a guy come to blows with me because he was prattling on about UCAVN. I said, it's a TLAM that goes out and comes back. You can recycle it. And he had a conniption. But there's some significant challenges, whether you're talking about the fact they are not cheap, they have a high loss rate, they rely on some pretty exquisite and delicate comms infrastructure to work. And when you actually get to the nuts and bolts of dynamic targeting in a very fluid environment, there are some limitations there. Have you seen the French, some initial indications, the directions that they were looking at going towards unmanned systems and what they've learned internally? Perhaps they're rethinking the direction they're going in?
Well, the key air asset that they've got is the Rafale. And so they're putting different kinds of systems on the Rafale. There's even a Rafale that can launch small satellites. So in a certain sense, the way I look at it is I look at RPAs, remotely piloted aircraft, as part of the future of aircraft, the future of air power. They're not the future of air power. And the reason for this is threefold before we even get to the dynamic targeting issue. First of all, they're not unmanned. You're talking a Predator is at least 350 people to operate this aircraft, and you can get up to 2,000 people operating a Global Hawk in terms of the entire structure. So they're not unmanned. And the second point is it's a flying data link, and it's a data link that can be jammed, spoofed, and whatsoever. And if we look at Northern Edge 2011, which for some reason people don't want to look at because in this particular exercise, the F-35 systems, you know, basically were so superior to everything else that we flew, 18s, 15s, whatever, and this can get a little dicey, but they were so much better, it raises questions about whether you want to keep flying the 18s, but that's a different issue. You've never flown a UAS in Northern Edge. Northern Edge is a jamming exercise, electronic warfare exercise, these things wouldn't survive a frying structure from 35As flying or a jamming from Rafales or F-18 Growlers and so on. So the second problem you really have is it's really a flighting data link. And this problem you had at Creech where the Air Force screens went blank is to be expected. So the idea of investing billions of dollars in this generation of so-called UAVs is a huge mistake. And the third point would be that once you really understand what a 35 is and what a 22 is, you're going to develop a whole new generation of RPAs. You know, one of our principals is Dave Detula, General Detula, who has obviously done a lot of work on how you're doing these things. And Secretary Wynn talks about the Wolfpack concept. You're going to want to use these things as part of your targeting and solution. But at the end of the day, the really difficult problem is that if you get into a pickup operation like Libya, and that if you're basically, you have a military that you can get, the main military threat to you can get rid of in 3 to 5 days, let's say that you could do that, although the way we're going and what we're buying, I'm not sure we will be able to, but then you're moving into an intervention force of some sort, whether you're helping rebels or whether you're putting special forces in or whatever you're doing. At that point, it's determining who you're supporting and exactly how that becomes very difficult. And in that particular situation, UIVs can be part of a solution, but they're not a terribly useful solution. Having somebody in the cockpit is probably a lot more useful. But it's part of the game. It's an important part of the game. Because if you look at Iraq, for example, the Marines found that the biggest use for unmanned vehicles for themselves, aerial vehicles, was if they'd done an operation somewhere in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you wanted to make sure that the bad guys had not come back, it was great to park one of these things over the AOR, over the area of interest, and let that thing to watch. And then you figure out some indicators, intelligence indicators, that the bad guys had come back. Very, very useful tool. It's a very, very useful tool. And again, on the website, I did an interview with an F-18 pilot, a Marine Corps F-18 pilot, who with significant Afghan experience, and he talked about the differences between the two and why the pilot and the cockpit is so crucial. But obviously, these are important tools. I think what's upsetting to folks, generally right now, is they're using the excuse of UAVs as cheap alternatives to getting the next generation aircraft, and they aren't cheap alternatives. And by the way, if you want some kind of strategic dominance or air dominance, you're not going to get that with a UAV.
Let me turn a minute back to the Libby operation for the question of the rules of engagement. You had some pretty funny comments from the French. This may be the first time they've actually had to deal with some of the NATO rules. Can you kind of describe the situation they found themselves in with the NATO ROE?
Well, the issue was it really was a tension between the United States and France. It's abstract on the website, but that's not the issue. The U.S. was leading the effort to have a very, very limited ROE, much like we had for a while in Afghanistan. And the French air operations chief, basically his position was, then we're not going to fight. Because in a situation like this, of course, you're going to kill civilians. What you're doing, clearly, is reducing killing the wrong people. But in a situation, he was very frustrated. Like most of us, you needed some kind of ground force in place, even if it was limited and inserted, that could be useful. So their frustration was, in this particular case, air operations, any operations, ground, air, anything. In fact, one of the things I don't understand is why is ROE discussion about air power? Basically, ROEs are about all forces, and the U.S. Army certainly has killed more civilians than the U.S. Air Force in Afghanistan or Iraq by mistake. But that's not an ROE. That's not, nobody looks at that. So at the end of the day, obviously what you're trying to do is to sort out who you're helping and who you're hurting, and you want to hurt the people that you want to hurt and help the people you want to help. And it's hard, as you well know. Anybody who's done combat, people aren't showing up with uniforms and identifying themselves as the target to be eliminated. They're not stupid, And the French made the point, and I'm sure the Marines did too, that after 3 or 4 days, after the Benghazi situation, and for about 3 or 4 days, the Gaddafi forces were using traditional military equipment, but then they realized it was Toyota truck time.
Yeah, I think I could probably help you out with the excessive air focus on ROE. I mean, part of it has to do with the fact that when you're dealing with air, almost all the time you have video that's either downlinked live that you can rewind, you can micromanage. You can't do that at the tactical level in the Army, so it's almost a matter of convenience. They do it because they can. Plus, aircraft, usually when they kill people, they kill them by the dozen, even with the small diameter bombs that we're using. But the kind of dealing with that issue...
You take my broader point, which is this should be a discussion of force, insertion of force, not specifically isolated like the Washington Post does to the aircraft that have created some kind of problem. And that's all my point is. I understand that, and the point is the fact that you can rack up video, but isn't that the point? The fact that you have pilots who are responsible for kinetic operations, who are well trained. These are not wanton murderers who are flying up there. They are trained professionals. they're under more stress than just about anybody on ROEs and trying to find out who they're supposed to be attacking. But it's very easy back in Washington to have, you know, to have views on this. It's much harder to actually execute correctly in a mission.
Yeah, it's not a perfect business by any stretch, and you know, a lot of that has to do with the ongoing press wars. But one thing that I found very frustrating, I know you have an advantage of the fact that you spent some time in Europe, and I believe that you're fluent in French, so you can get some diversity. But when I needed to get information that I considered useful about this Libyan operation, I had to go to the French press, I had to go to the British press, and a little bit of the German press. I was exceptionally disappointed with the American media's coverage and ongoing coverage of this operation. I haven't been to Europe since the Libya operation started, but having been there from a distance, and it's not just because their countries were in theory taking the point on it, but their coverage seemed to be more nuanced, in-depth, and frankly, honest than what I'm reading here. Is that a correct assumption on my part? And if so, why is that?
Well, maybe you're being overly optimistic about the European press, but
that's all relative.
But on the flip side of this, what is puzzling is you have virtually no coverage in the U.S. of this or this African little adventure that's starting right now. And I find all of this fascinating on three levels. First of all, politically, why did we do this, and what's the purpose for us? Then secondly, this incredibly arrogant concept that we're leading from behind. Now, my view is, I understand what leading an operation is. I understand and that you're making judgments about the objectives and the termination goals. I have no idea what leading from behind means. And I know what it meant in this particular case, which is the British and French were prepared for command and control of the operation, and the U.S. insisted, even though it wasn't delivering tactical air of any great significance, that we should do this. Now, I have a problem with that. Now, and the issue is, this is a very demonstrable issue. There's no coverage of this in the U.S. There's very, very little coverage on the role of the ARG and the Marine Corps. All you read about is the B is going to be too expensive or something like this. And you try to say to people, I'm going to double the, you know, we're cutting the Navy. We can double the capital ships. Who cares about the IOC cost of the B versus the C? It's irrelevant to what we're talking about. We're talking about value and capability. So this should be interesting. But then, again, this be even more bizarre. For 60 years, we've tried to come up with a supersonic vertical lift aircraft. So the WASP, except for us, we wrote two wonderful things on the WASP. There were maybe two other articles on the F-35B landing on the WASP. We interviewed the pilot, by the way, Schenck. We went to Pax River and interviewed him. This was an historic moment, the next 100 years of U.S. naval aviation. So you have to ask, you know, why is that not interesting? Why is the Libyan war not interesting? And why are we declaring victory when we have thousands of man pads out there? So what I don't understand is DHS has basically dismantled their man pads, efforts. And, you can say what you want about the Bush administration, but they were really keen on dealing with the man pads threat. So where's the story that says, goes ask the DHS secretary, okay, dear, what are we doing about the man pads threat? And even more significantly, I have trouble understanding an administration that's going to involve itself in this that wouldn't identify as our number one or two strategic effort here, securing those man pads. Now, I can tell you why, because they didn't want to put anybody on the ground. But what are we doing now? We're doing it through the State Department of Blackwater, or some contractors are supposedly doing something. It's too late. This stuff is already in Egypt and elsewhere. This is a very serious threat. So I don't see that the administration did a threat assessment of why Libya is important to us. Now, I would have done something in Libya myself if it was my administration because of just that threat. I don't want these thousands of missiles out. Some people say 20,000 missiles, but I don't know how anybody would count a number for an asset. We don't even know how many they were there. But obviously, it's a serious problem. So I think the fact that you have virtually nothing on this either. I think every story that's been generated by me with people. I don't understand. To be honest with you, I don't understand why this is so uninteresting. And you have the Arab Spring, an explosive situation in the Middle East. The Israelis have lost air superiority. We are in a situation where a conflagration of some sort is highly probable in the next few months. So, I'm not lackadaisical about this. I find this a very threatening situation, plus the fact we haven't closed the Libyan loop at all. We have no idea who's going to run Libya. We have no idea what's going to happen to the oil in Libya, and we're leaving Iraq. So the issue is a very fluid situation, and the broad failure is any strategic discussion about our equities and interests in this region at all. When I was in Israel in November, the air chief stood up in public and said, "We've lost air superiority, and I'm worried." Okay, so except for my website, I think you'd have a hard time even finding that stated anywhere. And that's the Israeli air chief. I don't think he's just being paranoid. I think it's true. So the bottom line is Libya is part of a broader set of dynamics in the Middle East and North Africa. Some are probably good, some are probably very negative, and some are neutral. But it's a very fluid situation, and given our dependence on oil in the region, you think that someone might wake up to this as being significant. But it's not debated in the Inside the Beltway newspapers at all, which is, I think, a strategic failure of the first order. Because for the Joe Sixpack is going to care when he starts seeing wars break out in the Middle East that were preventable. I don't want to be alarmist, but the issue is that I find it amazing that we're just treating this as a sidebar. It's the Mediterranean Sea, which, as you know, is a very small place.
Yep.
Well, out of all the, the where this goes, obviously, is the paths you could follow, or this could follow. Many of them are not good. I am interested in the fact that so few people have picked up on some of the aspects of the operation itself, which you have written about, but I've seen a few other places, which is this littoral warfare fought from sea bases using modern equipment, although the Osprey although it's only been in the fleet for 3 years, is 30-year-old design or something at this point. And, you know, I think you call it the logistical linchpin of the operation. You've discussed the situation with the air-sea forces. And I'm kind of interested in why that hasn't captured more imagination, or at least military comment on where this goes.
Well, I think the broad point I'd make is that so much of the analytical focus, if you look at AvWeek, for example, it's so platform-centric, it misses the whole point. I won't go back to the way I set up the website was very close to how the military itself thinks. It's about CONOPS, your capabilities to operate a certain way. And the historic equipment we've got are very, very limiting in terms of what we're doing. So it's very platform-centric. So you debate the Osprey based on where it was 30 years ago as opposed to the last 3 years. What is it doing? And how does that allow the Navy Marine Corps team and the Air Force team? The Air Force has significant MV-22s as well, as you know, and have been used. So I think part of it is just the platform-centric focus. Secondly, I think that we've been so bogged down in the wars that we're not going to fight. And you look at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I don't think he's gotten it yet that he needs an agile force structure for the Army, not this very heavy Army we're leaving behind. We're leaving around, and an interesting question would be to ask, how much equipment we're leaving the Iraqis would they ever use except to melt down? I mean, how usable is any of this stuff? So we don't seem to the appetite for what's the next decade look like. And from our point of view, it's about an agile force structure, how we can get more synergy across the forces. And as far as the air-sea battle, which you've mentioned in passing, this is not complicated. For the U.S., it's getting the Aegis to work with the F-35s, A's, B's, and C's, because most of our allies already own Aegis, and 30% of the fleet, 23% of the fleet of Aegis is foreign, but you would not know that either. So the issue is you either have no sense of urgency that you somehow think the U.S. has strategic dominance and by God's given it to us, or you're looking at a very fluid world in which we need to, even in financially difficult times, put together a much more effective force structure relevant to the 21st century. And, you know, I think another story, which I find interesting, I've written extensively about the F-18 in India. It was the worst-rated aircraft in the Indian competition, by far. Okay, and that's an objective assessment by the Indians. But, you know, except for me writing about this, nobody else writes about it. Now, the point is, the F-18's been an historically useful aircraft, and we're going to have it around for 25 years. That's not the point. We need to get on with some sense of urgency, how we get more capability out of what we've inherited, what we can get rid of, build our 35s, build out our force structure. And, you know, I travel around. I talk to a lot of the young people. We call them the iPad generation pilots. A lot of people are excited about what they're going to be able to do. But that excitement does not translate itself into the Congress or to the media inside the Beltway. And this will be not a good thing for the country. I'm hoping that we can turn that around and get some sense of excitement and capabilities. It's not about money, by the way. You can retire a lot of old stuff, put the new stuff in play, and come out with a better force structure.
Yeah, if you ever want to get the goat of a Hornet guy, just tell him, isn't the 18 the one that lost out in the competition to the 16 back in the 1970s? That's always a real popular thing to say to him.
But the whole approach that we're taking to this is, the new stuff allows me to get better value out of the old stuff. And the old stuff that's really too old to fly or float just needs to be retired. So it's about getting a strategic direction. It's a push strategy, a pull strategy, I'm sorry. You're pulling it with the new stuff, whether it be LCSs or DDG-1000s or whatever, into the new historic era. But anyway, going back to Libya, I find it interesting, and as we were discussing, that there seems to be about zero press on any of the tactical lessons or any of the dynamics, and certainly, the ARG got a lot of visibility, and then it was quickly interpreted that the ARG means you don't need the large deck carriers, and it was all about, it was very negative. It was, and I think it does, the newly enabled ARG does force questions about what the CVN does next, but that's, that's a policy and strategic question. It's not just one platform versus the other, and that's why I keep saying it's a platform conversation. Everything's a platform conversation, and that's how what we're talking about. How can the country build a 21st century strategy and capability? What does that look like, and what lessons can we learn for something like Libya? Now, the Libyan thing, I would add two things. One is that why I think the operation's worth thinking about very much is this kind of, we don't always want to lead an operation is an extremely important point. What we should be debating is, this was not well run from our side. And thank God for the Marine Corps, frankly, and for Colonel Dessens and his team. We need to think from a policy point of view, how do we do that? And that's extremely significant in the Pacific, which is what we're writing about now, in terms of how far do we help Japan? What are they supposed to do versus what we do? This is an important policy question just because of the nature of 21st century problems. The second thing is, I wrote this piece on black swans and power projection. Well, we've done a lot of work on rebuilding power projection. But I think the Libya thing kind of illustrates there are going to be a lot of times where you have no idea where the National Command Authority is going to send you. And so now it's a question of, how do I put an agile response group, that's what I call it, or other tools, into a situation that allow me to do a pickup operation effectively. And I think the third thing that we've got to really change our decision-making system, in a lot of cases we're going to want to insert force and withdraw force fairly rapidly, in weeks or months, not years. And that really is a political problem. And it's also building a different kind of force structure. But we have the tools available to us. Politically, it means recognizing I can get a certain effect and that's it. We did an interview with the strategic advisor to Massoud in Afghanistan, and he argued that, in fact, the light intervention the Bush people did was exactly what we should have done, and have left. So, I mean, that kind of debate is important, too. I mean, we can have views on this, but at the end of the day, we need a very flexible structure, and the maritime air forces are very important for this. And I'll simply make the final point. I've done a lot of work, 10 years of work, on what an Aegis 2235 package looks like. Very significant package, and we can talk about that. But it is about a lot of flexibility. Now, do I care whether there are A's or C's or B's that are working with Aegis? I don't care. Do I care whether there are A's or the Singapore's A's? I don't care. So at the end of the day, you have built into this new stuff the ability to answer some of the questions that we need to answer. So we've actually made some smart decisions. We now need to have the strategic guts to actually address the questions.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned about, you know, some of the PR, the R guide. Over at my home blog, I have a little underground of people, mostly JOs, that I keep in touch with. And a lot of the stuff they give me is just on background. I think one of the sad things is there is a lot of frustration from the Americans that were involved in living operation because I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second, then I'll drop off and ask you a question, Robin. But there was an active effort by the U.S. Navy and DOD not to tell our stories. There was a lot of good stuff people wanted to share and wanted to write, 100% unclass, but that was actively suppressed. It was really sad. I mean, the things they've told me would make great write-ups, but they were constantly told to sit down and shut up. But that's a different subject for a different day.
No, actually, let's hover over this point. I mean, what
sure.
We do on the website is I have dozens of interviews with TACC, the General McNabb at Transcom, and lieutenant colonels and colonels. We are unique in that. And the basic reason I'm doing that, because we learn a lot, but I have this strange presumption that somebody who's done something knows a lot more about what they did than I do. And I may be able to interpret it more effectively than they do. I'm actually pretty good at that. But at the end of the day, the knowledge that you gain from the operation is important. So we have virtually the only interview with the rescue team in Libya. And we should talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about that because that's an example. I interviewed, you know, Ed Timberlake and I interviewed Ed's an ex-Marine, a former, whatever they are. He's Marine Corps. He bleeds Marine Corps. But we interviewed Colonel Dessens, the 26th MUC commander, who was the commander of the ARG. We interviewed the 15th commander, Ozzy Osbourne. We interviewed the ace commander. I interviewed the ace commander and the Osprey guys down at New River when I was down there at the end of August, just before Hurricane Irene hit my house in the Outer Banks. Anyway, so what did I learn from this? Well, I have an interview that's up on the website, and I also have the ace commander. The ace commander highlighted this Osprey logistics role. He talked about many, many things, but I chose to focus on that because I think that is a really interesting development that has consequences for the Navy Marine Corps team, not just the Marine Corps.
It gave the ARG, in essence, a COD.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're paying the price once for the platform, and then you get all this other capability. The trap conversation was stunning because in this particular case, they got from the time they got the command to go until the pilot was back on the ship was 43 minutes. And the other part of the story is the Air Force had their rescue helicopters on the Ponce, but the folks there agreed that they couldn't do this in this period of time. Now, you can argue, does 43 minutes versus, say, 58 minutes matter? Well, the point is, if a pilot had been captured and Gaddafi got him, the political consequences are real. So Ed Timberlake wrote about the event avoided. And I'm a big believer on the event avoided. There are a lot of event avoided cases in Afghanistan of attempted strikes against the Osprey in Afghanistan and Iraq that didn't happen, that would have happened with a CH-46. Now, that doesn't make headlines, but if you're a warrior, it's something you know and you value, as opposed to having your ass blown up. So the point here is that entire operation showed the advantages over the Air Force system in this particular case. The Air Force system would require knowledge of where the pilot was, processing that information, making a command decision, offloading the information to the helo, and then the helo going in on a rotorcraft operation, which meant it would have had to go over the sand belts because of its range and all that. You don't have a forward operating base and all that. What the Osprey was able to do with the Harriers is the Harriers did the laser designations necessary for this operation. Now, when you have an F-35B, that thing will not only do that, it will suppress all the comms. It can suppress the SAMs. It will do all kinds of things, and it will give very good guidance to the Ospreys on where to go. And eventually, you'll connect the Ospreys and the bees effectively, and, you know, as you procure stuff. But the guy was able to fly on autopilot, something you can't do in a CH-46, which meant they spent their entire time thinking about the mission, preparing for the mission. The plane flew itself. The plane is very silent at its 300-plus miles an hour. They were going considerably faster than 300 miles an hour, but we'll leave that aside. And the issue is that the pilot didn't even hear the plane, it's a plane, until they went to rotorcraft mode. They landed 20 feet from him. Now, you know, you can say, okay, so big deal, but you and I both know that's an unbelievable technological and professional performance. And, you know, the Air Force guy comes out on the plane. He's happy to be on the plane. He's told the Osprey pilots, you know, please give my love to my wife. I may not make it. So, I mean, you have that kind of story that doesn't get out there. And runs on, and he looks at the Marines who have secured the area, and he said, those are great bazookas. And the Marine says, sir, we haven't had one of these bazookas for 50 years, son. So, and it turned out it's a small world because one of the Osprey pilots went to school with this Air Force pilot. So 43 minutes, and here's the other part. The command and control was all done on the ship, meaning that the Harrier pilots and the Osprey pilots met in the ready room of the Kearsarge and decided what they were going to do together. So it wasn't a long virtual office. And when I'll just add to that how important this is. I interviewed the commander of the Charles de Gaulle, the first one, and we talked about the Charles de Gaulle and the operation. He made the point that they used the de Gaulle in the Serbian operations, as you remember. And he said the big advantage of having the pilots on an aircraft carrier versus land was they were doing 24/7 thinking about air operations. They weren't going to their hotels. They weren't spending time with their mistresses. They were thinking 24/7 about the next airstrike. So the guys who had just done the airstrike would come down and talk to the guys about to do the next airstrike. So I think that these are unique advantages. It doesn't mean the Air Force is evil or we don't need the. This is not the silly point, because it is that each of these assets, each of these configurations has CONOPS advantages, and you need the spectrum of these CONOPS advantages to prevail in the wide range of threat environments that we have.
You know, there's a lot to be said for just being able to do things. I know in a lot of the as Americans, I know in some operations I've been in, we've never been able to fully utilize all of our assets, because if you're in a combined operation with your allies, many times you have to default to the lowest common denominator, especially in C4I systems, you know, whoever has the least capability. And in that light, we talked a bit about, you know, what lessons this gives for us going forward. But for our European allies, besides some self-serving comments by the British Prime Minister and the usual reaction by the Royal Air Force ignoring time and fuel usage, especially with the French experience and in some ways the British non-official communications from the Royal Navy, the Libyan operation has been kind of a wake-up to the Europeans on the inherent flexibility, utility, and if you want to be cheap about it, the cost effectiveness of an aircraft carrier. Has the French experience, especially with the Fulch, has that impacted the French defense establishment's view of carrier air and how they may want to modify their plans and programs going forward?
As you know, I mean, there is this Euro crisis, which is very, very significant, affecting not just budgets but just thinking strategically, and that's probably more important than anything else. But the two things I would say is that the British, and I gave a presentation to the British Embassy where I basically said, "You guys have shown us the way ahead in terms of what not to do." And by that, I wasn't being nasty. It is all the stuff that was eliminated in the Strategic Defense Review fought in Libya. And the consequences of this are huge. You need the aircraft carrier that was used. I've been on a couple of times. You know, it's expensive to operate these things theoretically, but as Secretary Wynn likes to say, a first-rate Air Force is better, is expensive, but a second-rate one's more expensive. And so it's a certain sense is, how do I get an agile, more capable compact force? Now, for the French, basically, I think it's different. I mean, they've been doing a lot of reforms and so on. They have their problems. They have a president who can take a decision. And whatever you like, think about Sarkozy, all of these leaders, he can take a decision and execute it. In fact, it was reported to me that their chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, their equivalent to Dempsey, basically kept telling Sarko how hard it was to do this. And he said, well, you get two choices. You do it or I fire you. Now, that's the kind of leadership I like myself. This is good stuff. But their own thinking is that what it did do was it validated more than the De Gaulle. It validated their 22,000-ton amphib ship because they put a lot of command and control in it. It's got a full deck. And they used the Tigers for the first time. So it actually showed the flexibility of what an amphibious ship can do. It also showed, as it did in Serbia, that having another base to operate off of vectors that are different than land bases are very useful. But I think the broad point I would make for the French have a base in the UAE now, is multiple basing is a good thing. The Mediterranean Sea is not that big. But having some sea bases that can operate along with your ability to use land basing and try to come up with a good configuration to leverage every asset you've got is really crucial. So we are in stringent times, but we don't have to be stupid.
Well, one of the other questions I was going to ask relates to something else I thought was sort of vindicated by the operation. You described it briefly, that in order to support their helicopter operations, the French had to use surface warfare officer. Of course, I'm more interested in this than I probably should be, but they did have to use surface gunfire to help pave the way for some of their operations. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, they had the Mistral offshore, and they were launching multiple helicopters. They don't have that many. The Tiger is their Apache. It's different than an Apache. It's more agile. It operates in a. It's like everything else. It's a better platform for the Apache than the Apache is for certain things. The Apache is better for other things. But what it showed, and this is really significant for us, is that Apache and the British showed the Apaches can fly off the deck of a carrier. I'm going to return to that in a minute. So they used their oldest. They used Gazelles. They used Escarioles. They used everything. But to get protection going in, the Tiger is not a problem because the Tiger has, ironically, you know what gun it has? It has the Comanche gun. And it's performed superbly in Afghanistan. Unbelievable gun. Now, one could easily ask why we can't put that on our own helicopters. That's, I suppose, a good question. In any case, they used the frigate gun power to provide corridors through which the helicopters could go more safely. And actually, you know, it's again, if you're limited in what you've got, what do you want to have? It does raise a question about the Zumwalt, which the American way is to figure out how to build something cost effectively and then cancel it. The Zumwalt has been simplified in ways. The Zumwalt would be very useful in the world we're headed for in terms of littoral operations, in my view. So the gunpowder side of this, again, you know, it seems like the critics want it both ways. They want to say we have no peer competitor, and if we have a peer competitor, they'll defeat us with these things designed to operate in littorals. Or they say none of this is useful, for littoral operations because the folks do asymmetric warfare and they never form targets. Well, unless you have a cloaking, unless you're a Klingon, I can find you. And it's about inserting force. And it's as simple as going back to World War II, inserting force has a certain logic all of its own, and you need to protect this. But yes, they used frigate gunpowder. And they showed that a frigate with a Mistral is an interesting combination, much better than just a Mistral by itself.
I thought that was a great operation there, because I think it demonstrated the inherent flexibility of I have a bias. My readers know I have a bias towards naval gunfire support, but it's not because I'm a major gun nut. It's because they're just so flexible, and they're so multi-mission and multifaceted. You just give people a mission they got to do, and it's going to be useful 9 times out of 10. But before we run out of time here, I wanted to kind of broaden the spectrum a little bit. And I heard something when I was driving back yesterday from a couple weeks ago. Dennis Miller was interviewing Representative Buck McKeon, Republican of California, in the House Armed Services Committee. And he made an interesting comment that when Leon Panetta was set up to be the Secretary of Defense to follow him with the Gates, he called Representative McKeon and told him, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said, Panetta did, "I'm 73, I'm not looking for a new job, and I'll be damned if I want to be known as a secretary that hollowed out the U.S. military." And we know with the fact that Congress punted and created the super committee, there's some very draconian things budget-wise that can happen to the military. If you have to go into a load monitoring system where you have to decide which one of your three children is not going to make it into the life raft, what would you offer based upon what you see as what we need to be prepared for? What do we need to jettison if we have to jettison something big? And what do we absolutely need to keep to be able to be prepared the next time we have to put our young men and women in harm's way?
Well, I think it's important that you mentioned Panetta, who was a congressman who has a real sense of reality, which not everybody in Washington does. And he is committed to agility. His military advisor is a Marine Corps general. And I think the critical question is, if you have to postulate what it is you need to do, and I'm not talking about yet another 1996 strategic commission, which I actually worked on, you have to say, you know, from my point of view, you're not doing these land wars again, and you're certainly not doing this way. You need agility. We have several new platforms we're building which give jobs to Americans and exports. So those are crucial in terms of restructuring where we're going to go. So it seems to me that you are going to cut the Army in half. You don't need all these ground troops. You got to make them agile. And agility for the Army will be driven by their partnership with the A and the Air Force, by basically mastering ground stations for all the air assets that are going to work with them. It isn't about their own UAVs and UAV killers. So you've got to address what is it the Army needs to do. And you have several elements in the current Army that could be leveraged to do this: special forces, paratroopers, and an ability to put force ashore, all that sort of thing. So that's the Army from my point of view. Now, the Pacific, what we're doing, laying out a very specific, how do you build a specific strategy, okay? And it seems to me that you want presence and scalability. That's your understanding. And the presence is crucial for protecting economic interests and sovereignty for the U.S. So the way we've drawn this up is we're looking at what presence forces do you have out there all the time. Well, you have the Coast Guard and the National Security Cutters, which are C4Is. C4Is are enabled. I've written a lot about these. You're going to forward deploy your LCSs, also C4Is are enabled. You're going to deploy an ARG or two, which with the newly enabled ARG will have the Bs on it. And then you've got Aegis out there that you're connecting to basically the Bs and so forth. Then you just go down the list of what you put out. You have SSN out there. We have SSGNs, which we've not figured out what to use out of those tubes. So if you start to think about, it's really about C4ISR connectivity and enablement and scalability, you realize how significant the F-35 is to the future, because it's a completely scalable asset that can call in all kinds of these other assets. So we wrote a piece that says we referred to Aegis as our wingman, basically. That's what you've got. If I wanted to kill an F-22, I'd find it with the F-35 systems, and I'd fire an SM-3 missile off of an Aegis, and I'd kill it. That's the way you have to start thinking about it. But if you don't have something that's scalable and that this equipment isn't C4ISR enabled. Look at the Navy. The Navy's done a very interesting upgrade to Aegis 51, to DDG 51, which was written about by my friend Chris Cavas at Defense News. They've done a very smart cycle of upgrades on the C4ISR suites. So we're doing a lot of nice things. It's a question of prioritizing, you know, highlighting the way this stuff works together. And how do we get best value for more agility, more sustainability, and more scalability? So it seems to me that you can come up with a way to do this that makes a hell of a lot of sense. And I would argue by the time we're done with the Pacific strategy, it'll be clear even to an idiot that we can do this and we can afford all of this. It's a question of getting rid of very, very old equipment that costs too much to float or fly to achieve an outcome. And so for us in the Pacific, the A's into Korea allow a whole lot of other change of how you work with the Army, how you use the maritime assets, how you redo the CVN with the C's on board. We've talked to the designers of the Gerald Ford. How does a triple sortie rate help, you know, the forward deployments? Because ultimately, to me, the Libyan case is a littoral operation from our point of view. And it is a harbinger of things to come. So the issue is, even though I don't think it's been handled brilliantly and the political decisions baffle me, from a military technical point of view, it shows the way. I would add a final point. The other frustration I have is, and our Pacific strategy, we barely mentioned China, by the way. I mean, what we did is we reversed the globe. The real globe is Hawaii in the middle and the Arctic in the north and Australia in the south. The Arctic, to me, is a big part of what the Pacific is. I'll just go to this point, that we have real threats in Korea, which we could manage by introducing a new capability, not just for itself, but how do I bring Aegis into the fight? How do I bring THAAD into the fight? In other words, we're at the point, it's not about being poor. It's about, you know, being adults and recognizing that we just need a lot more capability for a flexible, projectable force. We have not really focused on this for a long time. We haven't built new stuff for 50 years. When I was out at Yuma Air Station looking at the hangars being built out at Yuma for the 35, they haven't had a new hangar in 45 years. And I was talking, you know, a lot of these young people have never seen air-to-air stuff. When I go around with my friend Ed Timberlake, who's a Vietnam veteran, Marine squadron commander, and he always says, I'm the old guy, I'm not going to tell the new guys whatever. And I said, well, most of these new guys have never been in an air-to-air battle. They need some help. So I think it's part of it. If you're going to get flexible, if you're going to be projectable, if you're going to get better integration in what we're doing, you got to use the new stuff to achieve that. Because the other part of it is, when I deploy the historic equipment, it's a lot of infrastructure. I got to bring for CPG to go out, I need a lot of stuff. I know I can get the same effect without deploying a lot of stuff. So it's possible, it's doable. You got to have imagination. You got to quit doing one-up platform things. I will mention one last thing. I mentioned Northern Edge. Northern Edge is something you need to look at. We've written everything you can in an unclassified version on the website on this. But the amazing thing is Avweek did a double issue on ISR and never mentioned Northern Edge. Now, I find that interesting. How do you talk about the future of ISR and miss cyber operations and electronic warfare? Kind of an important issue, wouldn't you think?
Quite.
So the point is that my frustration is not that we can't do this. And we're ready to build the 35s. We have a factory that can build 20. We've already paid for the factory. It can build 20 a month. So the point is, to me, it's not about the 35. I referred to the 35 in early writings as a flying combat system. That's what this puppy is. And it's just an enabler of the bringing other stuff together. Because I'd like to be in a position that if an LCS is floating around and a bad guy thinks he should shoot at it, he could get a surprise strike from an SSGN or an SSN or ARG support. I want folks, anytime they see a U.S. asset, to know that I'm so connected and so scalable, you don't even want to think about killing us.
Well, on that note, Robin, it very quick hour. Thank you very much for joining us. And just a reminder to the listeners, if you'd like to read more of Dr. Laird's stuff, you can go on the web, fldinfo.com, for Second Line of Defense. And over there are in general, what are you working on that we might see here in the future?
Well, there are actually two websites that could be interesting to your readers. We have one called the Second Line of Defense Forum, which is just sldforum.com, where they can interact. What we're focusing on now is we've got a big Turkey series, because Turkey is, you know, it's a classic case of Turkey is, they think, people think of it as a secular state, increasingly not so, with what consequences. So we're focusing on that. We're continuing to focus on the future of combat using air power. That's obviously a core competence. And we're looking at LCS. We're looking at the evolution of the Coast Guard. You know, we're willing. We invite contributors to the website. People want to write something in the spirit of what we do. The main website is not partisan, and it is about capabilities. If people want to talk about capabilities that are in their area of commonality, we, you know, I pay a $200 honorarium for publications. I'm more than willing to do different things. We've done work on the maritime robotic systems with iRobot. With General Hines, the F-35 PEO is now at iRobot. And the ex-head of NAVAIR is the COO of iRobot. So maritime robotic systems are an important part of all of this as well. So there's almost no issue that we're not willing to look at, you know. The future of Eurofighter, the Arctic is a big area of interest that we focused on, and what people are doing. I'll be in Denmark in November doing some looks at how Copenhagen looks at all of this. And on that point, I just add one quick point, which is someone from the Air Force said, well, why does Denmark need a fifth-generation aircraft? Have you ever heard of Russia or the Arctic? I mean, so part of the problem is that the inside the Beltway conversation is a self-licking ice cream cone. And yeah, and I'm looking for people that are not interested in doing something other than self-licking their own ice cream cone.
Yeah, a lot of those people need to get outside the Beltway, not just in this country, to get out there. Well, thank you very much again for your time, Robin, and I wish you the best of luck, and we'll be reading your stuff soon.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good Sunday.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And thanks for everybody who joined us live or got us on the archive. Please join us again for another edition of Midrats.
Thank you, Joe.